And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Daniel Mason to the program today. Dr. Mason is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Stanford University. He is also a novelist, and his books, The Piano Tuner and A Far Country, have been translated into dozens of languages. And he has received a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. His new novel is The Winter Soldier, about a medical student from a wealthy and aristocratic Polish family in Vienna who decides to go to the front in World War I to become a battlefield surgeon. Daniel, Lucius Kaszlewski was born into a prominent Polish family, but he wasn't exactly expected or really welcomed, was he?
Right. So he's born into a family of Polish aristocrats who are living in Vienna. The family has come there a generation before. And they go way, way back.
All the way to Japheth on one side.
That's right. That was one bit that I discovered in reading about some of these aristocratic Polish families, that they actually trace their lineage all the way back to the son of Noah. I remember doing a double take when I came across that piece of information, thinking, that Noah? Yep, that Noah.
Given the anti-Semitism at the time, you know, how did they square that?
So his family's not Jewish.
We assume Noah and his family were Jewish.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's a good question. I didn't think about that, what they make of that Noah and what religion he was. That's a good question. I didn't think about that. It's interesting. I mean, his mom is a very practical person. I kind of suspect that she, also the fact that they're Poles who are living in Vienna at a time and experiencing some discrimination themselves. The anti-Semitism doesn't come up in the book specifically. I sometimes would wonder about whether or not she would be particularly anti-Semitic, or she'd be a little bit more modern in her orientation. But yeah, I don't know about what they'd think about Noah. On his dad's side, also, they go back to the great liberator of Vienna, a man named Jan Sobieski. So he has the bluest blood that anyone could imagine. But he doesn't feel part of, perhaps because of that, he doesn't feel part of that world. He talks about being born into a people for whom conversation was the ultimate art, and yet he can't even think of things to say at a regular cocktail party. Has to carry around little stones in his pocket to remind him what to say, practices beforehand, and really can't find his place until eventually begins to find it in science, but then as time goes on, more and more in medicine.
Now, his mother got a hold of the family wealth and based in mining and in metals, and she really improved the fortunes of the family with her no-nonsense attitude.
Right. His dad's side of the family has owned these mines for years, but they're these kind of lazy aristocrats. They have their money. They don't particularly need much more. His dad's really into his regiment. He had been in a cavalry regiment before he was injured, and then spends most of his time just sort of lounging around the garrison, playing cards, drinking with his buddies, reminiscing about old time. Doesn't have any mind for business, is a real traditionalist. But his wife is quite ambitious. So when she marries him and she discovers that the family owns these mines in southern Poland, and previously they're making things like trumpets, or they have a commission to make buttons for the army, which actually probably would have been a pretty big commission because they make a lot of buttons, but it's just buttons. She sets her sights on something much bigger, and they start making the railways for the empire, which, as you can imagine, is a pretty enormous commission. And so with that wealth, they've been moved to Vienna, and she really orients the family towards the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. So there's some outsiders being Poles, but at the same time, very much insiders because of their business interests and their association with the monarchy.
She was very prescient. She could see the coming turn from aristocracy to the more robber baron industrialists.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and she was a character for me that was very interesting to write, because between his parents, you almost capture these two different ages. His father, this 19th century romantically oriented man interested in not only the 19th century, but the centuries beforehand. He rhapsodizes at times about how the army really hasn't improved since the days that there were Polish cavalrymen who ran around with wings on the back of their armor. That was a great military in his mind. But his wife is completely different. She's very much oriented towards the future. She's capitalist. And she recognizes that this age in which Austro-Hungary is ruled by the Habsburgs is coming to an end, and that the new aristocracy is going to be a different aristocracy, essentially other capitalists with interests in mining and steel and other concerns. And so Lucius grows up with these two similar in some ways, and yet at the same time, given their outlooks on the world, very different people, one looking forward and one looking back.
Now, as the youngest son, why was his mother so opposed to him pursuing a career in medicine?
So from her point of view, I think people of her family didn't get their hands dirty. People didn't...
Oh, that's work.
That was work. She does a different kind of work. And so the idea that her son's going to be a doctor getting his hands bloody and taking care of common sick people, for her aristocratic mind, this is not a profession that one does. Now, there are certainly sons of wealthy families who would go into medicine, but as she points out to Lucius, she knows him very well, that kind of doctor is not the kind of doctor that Lucius would be. He's not interested in the social standing of medicine. He's interested in medicine itself.
Now, when he gets to medical school, he finds himself still an outsider with the German-speaking students
right
there. But he does strike up a friendship with another Polish student and, I guess, I assume a Jewish student,
right,
but with his name Foreman.
Right, right. And so at the time, Austria-Hungary was this real complex mix of inclusion and diversity and yet prejudices. So it is this country that contains lots of different nationalities all mixed together. Vienna was a very diverse city. And yet within the universities, there were still groups. For example, there were German medical student associations that would only allow ethnic Germans in the medical student associations.
Were they like the Bavarian fencing organizations where you have to get the scar and
right,
such?
Right. So exactly like that. So you'd have these medical students who would have fencing scars on their face. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so there would be maybe smaller or other organizations. I don't even actually know if there are other organizations, but minority students at the time expressed the sense that they were outside that social world there. And so Lucius first encounters his friends. One of them's a poor Pole who's on scholarship. The other's a Jewish student whose family had migrated to Vienna. He finds them among the other students not accepted within these organizations.
And it's there where Lucius really flowers. His stammer falls away when he's speaking about medicine. He's very engaged, becomes a top student, if not the top student in the school. And then he develops an interest in radiology. Why do you think he has this interest in radiology?
Right. I think for a couple of reasons that he's drawn to it. On one hand, medicine now is what he can do and what he can do well. So he's drawn into it just because medicine's fascinating and he's encountering it for the first time. But he's also somebody who's had difficulty understanding other people, where his mother has this very sharp insight into others and their motives. For him, other people are mysteries. Understanding another's mind is a mystery. And so to all of a sudden be offered this kind of technology, which at that time very primitively promises the chance to see through the skin, through the skull, and into the brain, is for him quite bewitching, even if the technology to actually see thoughts is something that's very far away. And so he's drawn to radiology, principally neuroradiology, because of the possibility of seeing into the minds of other people.
And we do get to meet an extremely famous historical personage. Marie Curie comes across the scene.
Right. So she's the major cameo appearance in the book of a true historical person. I have to remind myself whether or not there's actually anyone else really truly appears and has a speaking role. But at that period of time, she'd already won 2 Nobel Prizes. She's a legend in medicine and chemistry, but she's, for the Polish community in Vienna, as I describe in the book, she's almost a saint. So he, one night, is at the university with his professor. He ends up working with this very eccentric professor who was quite famous for a book that he had written several decades before, but since then has become a bit more senile as time goes on. And the two of them are at the university because the professor has it in his mind that what they're going to do is find a specimen of a mermaid in the medical school's museum and take an x-ray of it to prove whether or not it's actually a mermaid or it's a hoax. Something which Lucius thinks is a bit ridiculous because, of course, it's a hoax. And yet his esteemed professor seems to think it's actually something that could be. And so they go down there, sure enough, find this sort of old, dried up specimen of sorts, and are taking it out, walking down the hall of the university, when they come across the rector, who is escorting Marie Curie after a lecture. And she, in encountering them, recognizes another Pole and switches into Polish and begins to talk to him, and then invites Lucius to dinner, all of which is both thrilling to him, but mortifying because he now has in this rucksack that he's carrying on his bag this dried up specimen of what's purported to be a mermaid.
Did you see in her writings or papers anywhere that she had expressed an exhaustion of speaking German all the time?
No, so that I made up. I took a lot of liberties with her. I didn't come across in her writings any reference to dried up mermaid specimens either. But I imagine someone like that, so famous, being brought all about Europe and asking to give lectures in a language that was not her native tongue must have been quite exhausting.
Heading back to his wanting to know why people think and such, you had the line about his attribute, an unusual aptitude for the perception of things that lie beneath the skin. Now, when you wrote that, did you say, I'm done for the day? Uh-huh. That's just a great line.
That's funny that you asked that. That's one of the oldest lines in the book. So the book's taken me a really long time to write. I've been working on it for 14 years from when the idea first came. And I would say that line probably has been there from year one in thinking about this young man who both has the intelligence to understand certain technical aspects of medicine and yet at the same time has an essential difficulty with understanding the motives of other people. And so to be proclaimed someone who has the ability to see things beneath the skin is not only this accolade, but it's aspirational for him. He dreams of that.
Now, you mentioned the multinational nature of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Could you give us a little idea of the scope of how large it actually was right before the beginning of World War I?
I wish I had actual numbers, but I can say that when you look at the maps, it's much of Central Europe. So in the east, it covers Hungary, extends over the Carpathian Mountains into an area of southern Poland called Galicia, which extends all the way up against the Russian frontier. In the south, it extends down through the Balkans, abuts Italy, and then runs through the mountains of is Austria today and into southern Germany. So it's huge territory, taking into account a dozen major languages, not to mention like all the other dialects that are in that area.
I was not familiar with Ruthenian.
Yes. So that was also a dialect that took some time for me to figure out exactly what a Ruthenian person would have been speaking. So Ruthenian is a language which I think sounds very much like modern Ukrainian that's spoken in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was spoken in this mountainous region in the Carpathians and in the area that eventually would become the Ukraine. And so Ruthenian was a word that used in many ways, and there's some complicated books that talk about Ruthenian identity, because I think it's a fascinating topic of its own, but essentially to describe a group of people who today would be speaking language similar to Ukrainian, but are living in these mountain valleys in the easternmost regions of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The Ruthenian I've encountered both to describe more of a lowland Ukrainian, but also to describe groups that are mountain groups, so tiny little villages, speaking a kind of Ruthenian that sometimes was in dialect, and so that I think was so different that one village would speak a language that almost sounded different from the other.
And this must have been a very exciting and very confusing time when you have all of these local dialects and pockets of people who don't have contact with the outside world, and then you have the age of industry and travel becoming so much easier that you have all of these forces coming together.
Right. That's something that I found myself thinking a lot about, because when the war starts and there's this huge sweeping movement from Russia in the east, but then also Austro-Hungarian forces pushing up north into the mountains and war bringing destruction to many of these villages, a lot of people from the Carpathians flee to the larger cities. Some of this was something that I had to imagine, but some of this is something that I'd encounter in photographs, pictures of refugees from these mountain villages camped out on the roadsides while troops are marching along these wide roads, but also thinking about what would it be like for a villager dressed and they have absolutely beautiful traditional clothing that they would wear for festive holidays, for this person to be all of a sudden find themselves in Vienna, which is not actually that far away as the crow flies, but as they flee the war, they would be settling in cities, which must have been an extraordinary culture shock.
Now, when the war begins with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, his mother understands this is an opportunity to sell not only the metals that munitions are based on and weaponry, but also for the rebuilding of the country when it eventually comes.
Right. She recognizes before Lucius, not surprisingly, that times are changing. And she's always been concerned that because their family is about to become even wealthier by selling metal to the army to rebuild all the rails that are going to be destroyed, there's a risk that her family is going to be accused of being profiteers. And so all of her other sons are older and uninterested in serving. But she recognizes in her younger son the possibility that she might have a potential war hero on her hands. And in the beginning, at least, he thinks that it might be as dramatic that she thinks that she almost has a sacrifice of sorts on her hands. As the book progresses, and I think as he comes to understand them more, her more, and they have a little bit more of an approximation, I sometimes wonder if that was actually the case, that she's not actually offering up her son to be killed. But certainly at the time, he senses that there's that kind of motive behind her enthusiasm in his enlistment.
And his father's attitude, he wants him to enlist in the Polish Lancers and carry on the tradition of a jolly good war.
Right, right. I mean, his father is overjoyed. The son that he doesn't understand all of a sudden is now going to be a soldier like him. So ideally, he'll be a Lancer like his father. And his father doesn't particularly understand that Lucius is actually going to be a doctor, despite Lucius explaining this many, many times to his father. And so his father brings out his service revolver to teach Lucius how to shoot. They shoot down the hallway of their mansion in Vienna because that's the best place that he can find to have good target practice. They try on this antique armor that his father has collected over time, which is armor of a winged hussar regiment. So these are the Polish cavalrymen that I mentioned earlier, who would wear, in addition to their armor, these gigantic wings with ostrich plumes on them. And historians differ as to the actual purpose of these, whether they're just supposed to be intimidating or they make a particular kind of sound or maybe they're just decorative, but they're quite extraordinary in appearance. And so the two of them end up trying on this armor, which Lucius at first thinks is ridiculous because this is not the war that he's going to fight. And he at the same time finds in that moment a point of contact with the father that he's never really been able to connect with before.
And so he hasn't finished his medical studies yet. He's not been awarded his medical license. And one of the reasons why he's spent so much time with Zimmerman, his professor, studying radiology, he hasn't been attending to his other classes.
Right. So attendance in a class was voluntary. You just needed to pass the exams. And so he thinks that, in part because he's pretty good student, that he can study all he wants on his own. He doesn't need to go to classes. He doesn't need to practice out at rural clinics over the summer like some of the other students need to. He's going to be making a great discovery. That's his thought. And so when the war starts, he's really far behind when it comes to practical experience. His friend, Feuermann, has at least spent, like most students would, summers out in rural country clinics doing standard meat and potato doctor kind of stuff, fixing wounds, giving birth to babies. But Lucius doesn't know how to do this. He knows how to come up with some complicated chemical solution to try to get a good image on an x-ray. So he's utterly unprepared. All of the young students, many of whom who had no clinical training at all, are unprepared for the responsibilities of war. But Lucius is really, really unprepared.
Now, before he gets to meet the enemy, he has to meet something that might even be a greater obstacle to overcome, and that's the bureaucracy.
Right. I'm glad that you noticed that in the book, because that's a big theme.
And
that's
because this might have been the golden age of bureaucracy,
right,
with this, just the stamping, stamping, stamping.
Right. And there was constant bureaucracy. And in one way, the way that I came about writing it was, in part, I was trying to understand this basic kind of question, like what seemed to me to be a relatively straightforward question. What were the mechanics of getting deployed? Like, how would this happen? Who would he go to? Who would tell him? How would he be transported? And I couldn't find anywhere a how-to guide of sorts. And I would read different accounts, and they would mention different ways that men would be sent off to the front, and they differed, and so it was quite confusing. And at a certain point, I ended up falling back on that old adage for writing, which is, if it's a problem of the novel, make it a problem in the novel.
Ah.
So if he can't figure out the bureaucracy, then maybe him not figuring out the bureaucracy actually would be a plot point of sorts. And then it ended up being quite fun to write those scenes, a kind of poetics of bureaucracy in which a form makes its way to the second floor and then the third floor and gets stamped here, like you're saying. And so then eventually, when he gets deployed, it takes up almost an entire page of the book of this particular form making its way to different departments, ending up being covered with smudges of paprika and other foods because some guy was eating when he was handling
the Hungarian.
Fork. That's right. So some Hungarian was dribbling paprika on Lewis's deployment forms. And who knows if that's, I'm sure it didn't happen exactly that way, but certainly if you read a lot of the great, especially sort of absurdist literature of that time period, one thing you encounter constantly is the terrorism of this bureaucracy, that people were just trapped. And so the army made huge mistakes, which were big military mistakes, but from a medical perspective, people not being sent supplies, being sent boxes that had all the appropriate paperwork, but instead of bullets, it'd be pickles that would arrive, which the men don't totally mind when that happens in the book. But this was a story that I encounter again and again. Also, I'm a physician. I encounter a lot of bureaucracy in my work too, so it was a good way of sublimating some of my frustrations as well.
And also, it continued on. I just recently interviewed Hampton Sides. He wrote a book about the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir and the Korean War. And in the American side, they had a nickname for artillery shells, and it was Tootsie Rolls. And they had requested so many Tootsie Rolls, and the clerk took them literally.
Oh, wow.
Instead of, as for the euphemism, wow. And they send them thousands and thousands of Tootsie Rolls.
Wow, what a great story. Wow.
Now, finally, he gets orders, and he's dispatched to Limnavitsa. Is that right?
It's an invented town, so I think we can probably pronounce it any way we want.
How do you pronounce it?
In my own mind, it was Limnavitsa.
Limnavitsa.
But I don't know if that's how it's pronounced.
He's dispatched to Limnavitsa, to a field hospital there, and he is not prepared in the slightest.
Right. At first, he's reluctant to join the war because he sees the war as getting in the way of his studies. But then when he hears of the physician shortages, he gets a little bit more interested. And his first thought is that he's arriving at a very well-run field hospital because that's what he's been reading about in all the war propaganda. It's going to have a bacteriological laboratory. It's going to have an X-ray machine. And so he's a little bit concerned when he has a solitary escort across the mountains, takes 2 days, and that brings him into this village where he doesn't see any kind of building that looks like it could be a hospital. And the escort takes him to the door of the church, which he realizes has been commandeered as a hospital/field station because it's really primitively supplied at that point. And then, even more to his horror, understands that the last doctor who was there essentially went mad during a typhus epidemic. The nurses were all killed during the typhus epidemic except one. And this nurse, Sister Margareta, has been essentially running the hospital by herself since that happened. At that point, Lucius has his 2 years of preclinical training. He's also broken his hand because he slipped on an icy street when he was back in Hungary waiting to be deployed. And so arrives as this untrained medical student with a broken hand, suddenly realizing he has to be the primary surgeon in this hospital, serving all of these wounded men.
Be careful what you wish for.
Right.
And this nurse that's there is a member of a religious order. We're not quite sure which one. And her name is Margareta, and she is extremely competent.
Right. So from the beginning, she says that she's from the Order of St. Catherine, but Lucius's not so sure what this means because he hasn't heard of the Order of St. Catherine, but of course he's not a particularly devout person and certainly doesn't know about different orders of nuns. So he sort of takes that at face value at first, and it's only as time goes on that he begins to really wonder where she might actually be coming from. But at least from the beginning, it seems like he's found himself with a nursing sister. He's worked with nursing sisters before the hospital back in Vienna, but none of them are like this nurse that he's encountered, who he realizes both to excitement, but primarily horror at the start, has been essentially performing all the surgeries herself, and that she's learned from the doctor beforehand, but she's learned just a couple months. And yet she seems to be quite competent. And I think this is one of the themes that he begins to encounter, that he's somebody who comes from this really elite education back in Vienna, the top medical school in the empire. And yet he can't do what this woman, who he realizes has rudimentary education because he's her handwriting, and her handwriting is the handwriting of a child. And yet she's
a doctor.
Or a doctor, right, right, right. I think that would maybe be doing a disservice to children. But she hasn't trained, and yet she's the one who knows how to take care of the soldiers, and he's going to learn from her.
Now, we mentioned that she's the only woman there, but she's not the only she there, and the she is the louse.
Right. When he starts talking to her at first, she has this long, begins with this very pressured, anxious, almost crazed monologue about what happened at the hospital before he arrived. And she begins first with this elevated religious speak, speaking about God and using the typical capital he or him to describe God, but then begins to talk about this other entity who she refers to in feminine as she or her, and what she's referring to is this the entity of the Laos, not a lice in general, but sort of the concept of the Laos. And the hospital has been hit by a typhus epidemic. Around that time, people had understood that it was carried by lice, but no one understood how to control this, or then there's no treatment except good nursing. This mythical devil-like she that Margareta refers to has wiped out much of the population in the hospital and is an obsession for her. So the Russian cavalry might be something to fear, but the Russian cavalry is nothing compared to the dangers of the Laos.
So what are the symptoms of typhus, and how does it actually kill a person?
You're asking a psychiatrist about the symptoms. So actually, I'll rely on my research for the novel mostly, actually. I've never seen this case of typhus in my life, thank God. But it's an infectious disease. It's carried by lice. It presents with fever as well as general symptoms of illness, flu-like symptoms, confusion, delirium. It was often noted that young men would cry out in this particular kind of way that people thought was indicative of typhus. And then, you know, as far as what ended up killing them, it's actually a good question what most deaths from typhus ended up being from, whether it was kidney failure, whether it was dehydration, whether it was cardiovascular collapse. I'm not exactly sure what sort of the final point that led them to die was.
And beyond the horrors of injury that can be suffered in war, there's another disease or condition that becomes paramount in the story and all across the various theaters of the war, and that is, at the time, is known as shell shock, PTSD.
Right. So that, for me, as I was researching it, was this moment in which writing the book collided with the highest velocity, I could say, with the rest of my life, which is the practice of psychiatry, and was both intriguing to read about, but also part of research for the book that I think ended up changing a bit the way that I think about patients even today. So doctors had recognized in the 19th century and earlier that experiencing trauma can result in psychological and physical symptoms. This had been recognized, but no one was prepared for the magnitude of this effect that was observed in World War I. And it was so severe that their accounts on all sides of the conflicts of the medical high command sending out medical investigators to field hospitals to try to figure out why it is that all of a sudden so many of their soldiers are falling ill with essentially this combination of psychiatric as well as neurological conditions, neurological and other physical conditions that couldn't be explained, that didn't follow the well-known patterns of neurological disease. Because one thing that had been observed for a long time in medicine and pretty well understood at that point is that the nerves in the body follow a particular distribution from the brain all the way down. And when you suffer an injury to them, it tends to result in particular patterns. But these men who were coming down with, for instance, paralysis or trembling or seizures or the inability to speak, their symptoms didn't conform exactly to these well-understood patterns from beforehand. So it wasn't understood what was going on. There were all kinds of theories at the beginning of the war, some people proposing very organic theories that maybe it was that now in this war we're using explosives that are much more powerful than previous wars, and so perhaps these high explosives are sending microscopic particles of dust through the skin and the skull and into the brain, and it's resulting in injuries that we've never seen before. But then there were a lot of other doctors that recognized that perhaps it was the intense fear that men were experiencing and the exhaustion of fighting in these horrific conditions that itself was resulting in this, I don't want to say new disease, but certainly new in some of the particularities of its presentation, but certainly new in its magnitude.
Because in the Civil War, it's known as soldier's heart.
Right. So that's this fascinating part about the psychological response to trauma, the psychological and physical responses to trauma. and that it can very much vary over time depending on the culture or the environment in which the illness is manifesting itself. And so what was the pattern that tended to be reported more during the Civil War era were palpitations and weakness and breathlessness that doctors felt were resulted to damage to the heart due to overstrain of some sort. That also is noticed in the First World War as well. And shell shock isn't the only syndrome, post-traumatic syndrome, that's encountered in the First World War, but it's certainly the most famous and the most emblematic psychological condition of the war.
Have you had a chance to treat any veterans who were in Iraq or Afghanistan? And what's the current thinking in medicine on PTSD, just briefly?
Sure. I did part of my training at a veterans hospital. And now the collection of symptoms that we tend to see after psychological trauma is different. It tends to be a little bit more psychological in nature. So we see less of the neurological symptoms. It would be uncommon, I would say, for someone to be near a bomb that goes off in Iraq or Afghanistan and then several weeks later develop a paralysis of their arm. So that not immediately after the blast, but several weeks later. So a kind of paralysis that's felt to be psychologically linked. That might be a pretty common presentation in World War I. Now, PTSD presents very differently in each person, but often involves memories, symptoms of trying to avoid memories of what happened, symptoms of being overly vigilant to prevent what happened from happening again, withdrawing from the world, difficulties sleeping, difficulties in memory. So it looks a bit different. One part of this that's been interesting for me since the book has come out is that a number of people, as well as readers who have had parents or grandparents who served in the First World War, have told me about them. And just recently, I was having a conversation with a friend who's in his 80s, who remembers his father quite well. And he was describing how his father, after the war, had developed amnesia based on what had happened in the war. And as we were talking about his father, I realized that he was describing to me a case of a soldier with shell shock. And though I had never had a patient nowadays who developed amnesia after fighting, although it certainly could happen, here I found myself hearing about this other man from nearly a century before presenting with these symptoms that I had read about.
Psychiatry is very different from psychoanalysis, and we're in Vienna in the early 20th century, and so there's only just one very oblique reference to Freud.
Right. I'm glad you picked that up. Right. Originally, in this early version of my book, there was actually a cameo appearance for Freud also, but I ended up having to take that out. It was probably the cut that I most regretted having to make. In the long genesis of this book, there was a after story that occurred once Lucius returned to Vienna, and it was this whole other novel, I could almost say, with this other patient, and Lucius was going to consult Freud about this other patient, but the other patient was cut from the book, so Freud was subsequently cut from the book. Also, Lucius is practicing a very mainstream medicine, and the psychiatry that he's learned is the psychiatry that's taught at the university, and at this point in time, Freud is famous, Freud's notorious, and doctors know about him, but in the book, Freud is encountered as much by civilians and non-physicians as it is by physicians. So Lucius is aware of his writing, but not that aware. In fact, it's one of his future wife-to-be who has read Interpretations of Dreams, while Lucius hasn't, and she's interested in it almost as a kind of like parlor game, like people would interpret each other's dreams using Freud's book, non-doctors.
Well, she should have known about the Oedipal complex and stayed far away from Lucius and his mother.
Right, that's right. Yeah, so that I think that Lucius's relationship with his mother is quite a juicy mind for people interested in an Oedipal complex.
Of all the horrible things happening to characters throughout the book, we as readers in the early 21st century know that even more horror is to descend on Europe just a couple of decades later.
The book ends, I guess, 1919. And so there's this relief that the war is over and this sense of hopefulness that everyone can begin again and begin to reconstruct their lives again. Ultimately, I think that the book is a hopeful book. Even though it's a very dark period of time, I felt necessity for my own sanity to write a book that's hopeful, at least in the moment. And yet hanging over all of that, of course, is that here are these characters who we've come to feel a lot of affection for, hopefully. I certainly felt affection writing about them. And yet at the same time, less than two decades later, another conflict is gonna convulse Europe. I was drawn to this, the myth of Cadmus sowing the dragon seeds, and so Cadmus kills the dragon, and so dragon's teeth, kills the dragon and sows his teeth in the ground, and up from the teeth grow this race of fearsome warriors, and they go on to found Thebes. But this idea that one conflict creates these skeletons of sorts, and then from the skeletons grow this fiercer race, is something which thematically resonated with me.
It's almost like it's societal PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that trauma certainly does not resolve itself quickly.
Now, did you have to study a lot of history of medicine when you were studying for your medical degree?
Very little. And I regret that, because I find that the history of medicine is quite helpful for contemporary practice. We're taught a little bit, but it's usually as kind of a background, thinking about how our predecessors in medicine didn't really understand things. And then eventually, as time went on, we became more rational and problems were illuminated. And now we understand and have answers. And while that's certainly true in many areas, I feel like the history of medicine has a lot to offer. The example of PTSD that we were just talking about, I think is an excellent one. This question of how psychological trauma can occur, but the way that symptoms occur post-psychological trauma are shaped very much by culture and environment is a great lesson from history. And that's something that we observe not only in comparing patients from the United States versus other patients throughout the world, but even in local populations. The way that people fall ill is due not only to biological forces of the illness, but also to the people who are around them and the environment that they're in. And so history offers a great example of that.
A couple of centuries into the future, what do you think they might think, that we were barbarous in our in our service of medicine?
Wow. Well, I think probably a couple of decades into the future, they'll think that we're barbarous. Medicine seems to me to be advancing so fast. You know, in psychiatry in particular, there's this dream of developing much more targeted therapies, because now the therapies that we have, the effective therapies that we have, are still very general. And many of the diagnoses that we diagnose on paper are said to be something that look different. But we're finding, actually, if you look at using scans or you're looking at using genetics, share a lot in common. And so there's this sense that though we've made incredible strides in the last few decades in treating a lot of mental illness, illnesses which 100 years ago were completely untreatable and might mean that a person would spend their life in an asylum, are nowadays treatable and a person can return to the community and get a job and have a family. Nonetheless, the mind is so mysterious that we find ourselves really in a state of not knowing what's going on. So hopefully, we don't have to wait a couple centuries to have a better sense of how the mind works when it's well, and then also when it falls ill.
And I know we won't have to wait a couple of centuries, but do you think you might finish your next book in less than 14 years?
Right. Well, I really hope. I know we're not going to have to wait a couple of centuries if I'm going to take that long. So I'm hoping to write a collection of short stories next, and I've written most of them already. So I feel more comfortable saying that it's closer to being done than I've ever felt saying that I feel a novel is done. So hopefully I can finish the last couple short stories in the next few years.
Well, Daniel, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and speaking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
Daniel Mason is the author of The Winter Soldier, which is published by Little Brown. I'm Stephen Usfury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.